"Does this museum have a Foucault pendulum?" she asked the guard. The sound of her heels echoed on the marble floors as she approached the rotunda. Joss was leaning over the railing, peering at a mosaic tile representation of the cardinal directions. There were small vertical hour marks, some upright, others evidently knocked down by the bob earlier in the day. Around 7 p.m., someone had stopped its swing and it now hung motionless. They were entirely alone. He had heard her approach for a minute at least and had said nothing. "You've decided that prayer can stop a pendulum?" she smiled.
"That would be an abuse of faith," he replied.
"I don't see why. You'd make an awful lot of converts. It's easy enough for God to do, and if I remember correctly, you talk to him regularly." "That's not it, huh? You really want to test my faith in the physics of harmonic oscillators? Okay." A part of her was amazed that Joss would put her through this test, but she was determined to pass muster. She let her handbag slide off her shoulder and removed her shoes. He gracefully hurdled the brass guardrail and helped her over. They half walked and half slid down the tiled slope until they were standing alongside the bob. It had a dull black finish, and she wondered whether it was made of steel or lead. "You'll have to give me a hand," she said. She could easily put her arms around the bob, and together they wrestled it until it was inclined at a good angle from the vertical and flush against her face. Joss was watching her closely. He didn't ask her whether she was sure. He neglected to warn her about falling forward. He offered no cautions about giving the bob a horizontal component of velocity as she let go. Behind her was a good meter or meter and a half of level floor before it started sloping upward to become a circumferential wall. If she kept her wits about her, she said to herself, this was a lead pipe cinch. She let go. The bob fell away from her. The period of a simple pendulum, she thought, a little giddily, is 2 pi, square root L over G, where L is the length of the pendulum, and G is the acceleration due to gravity. Because of friction in the bearing, the pendulum can never swing back farther than its original position. "All I have to do is not sway forward," she reminded herself. Near the opposite railing, the bob slowed and came to a dead stop. Reversing its trajectory, it was suddenly moving much faster than she had expected. As it careened toward her, it seemed to grow alarmingly in size. It was enormous and almost upon her. She gasped. I flinched, Ellie said in disappointment as the bob fell away from her.
Only the littlest bit?
No, I flinched.
You believe? You believe in science. There's only a tiny smidgen of doubt.
No, that's not it. That was a million years of brains fighting a billion years of instinct. That's why your job is so much easier than mine.
In this matter, our jobs are the same.
My turn, he said, and jarringly grabbed the bob at the highest point in its trajectory. But we're not testing your belief in the conservation of energy. He smiled and tried to dig in his feet.
What are you doing down there? A voice asked. Are you folks crazy?
A museum guard, dutifully checking that all visitors would leave by closing time, had come upon this unlikely prospect of a man, a woman, a pit, and a pendulum in an otherwise deserted recess of the cavernous building.
Oh, it's all right, officer, Joss said cheerfully. We're just testing our faith.
You can't do that in the Smithsonian Institution, the guard replied. This is a museum.
Laughing, Joss and Ellie wrestled the bob to a nearly stationary position and clambered up the sloping tile walls.
It must be permitted by the First Amendment, she said.
Or the First Commandment, he replied.
She slipped on her shoes, shouldered her bag, and head held high, accompanied Joss and the guard out of the rotunda. Without identifying themselves, and without being recognized, they managed to talk him out of arresting them. But they were escorted out of the museum by a tight phalanx of uniformed personnel, who were concerned perhaps that Ellie and Joss might next sidle aboard the steam calliope
in pursuit of an elusive god. The street was deserted. They walked wordlessly along the mall. The night was clear, and Ellie made out Lyra against the horizon. "The bright one over there, that's Vega," she said. He stared at it for a long time. "That decoding was a brilliant achievement," he said at last. "Oh, nonsense. It was trivial. It was the easiest message an advanced civilization could think of. It would have been a genuine disgrace if we hadn't been able to figure it out." "You don't take compliments well, I've noticed." "No, this is one of those discoveries that change the future. Our expectations of the future, anyway. It's like fire, or writing, or agriculture, or the Annunciation." He stared again at Vega. "If you could have a seat in that machine, if you could ride it back to its sender, what do you think you would see?" "Evolution is a stochastic process. There are just too many possibilities to make reasonable predictions about what life elsewhere might be like. If you had seen the Earth before the origin of life, would you have predicted a katydid or a giraffe?"
"Oh, I know the answer to that question. I guess you imagine that we just make this stuff up, that we read it in some book or pick it up in some prayer tent.
But that's not how it is. I have certain positive knowledge from my own direct experience. I can't put it any plainer than that. I have seen God face to face." About the depth of his commitment, there seemed no doubt. "Tell me about it." So he did. "Okay," she said finally. "You were clinically dead. Then you revived, and you remember rising through the darkness into a bright light. You saw a radiance with a human form that you took to be God, but there was nothing in the experience that told you the radiance made the universe or laid down moral law. The experience is an experience. You were deeply moved by it, no question, but there are other possible explanations."
"Such as?"
"Well, like birth.
Birth is rising through a long, dark tunnel into a brilliant light.
Don't forget how brilliant it is. The baby has spent 9 months in the dark. Birth is its first encounter with light. Think of how amazed and awed you'd be in your first contact with color or light and shade or the human face, which you're probably pre-programmed to recognize. Maybe if you almost die, the odometer gets set back to zero for a moment. Understand, I don't insist on this explanation. It's just one of many possibilities. I'm suggesting you may have misinterpreted the experience."
"You haven't seen what I've seen."
He looked up once more at the cold, flickering, blue-white light from Vega, and then turned to her. "Don't you ever feel lost in your universe?
How do you know what to do? How to behave if there's no God? Just obey the law or get arrested?"
"You're not worried about being lost, Palmer. You're worried about not being central, not the reason the universe was created. There's plenty of order in my universe. Gravitation, electromagnetism, quantum mechanics, super unification, they all involve laws. And as for behavior, why can't we figure out what's in our best interest as a species?"
"That's a warm-hearted and noble view of the world, I'm sure. And I'd be the last to deny that there's goodness in the human heart. But how much cruelty has been done when there was no love of God?
And how much cruelty when there was? Savonarola and Torquemada loved God, or so they said. Your religion assumes that people are children and need a boogeyman so they'll behave. You want people to believe in God so they'll obey the law. That's the only means that occurs to you. A strict, secular police force and the threat of punishment by an all-seeing God for whatever the police overlook. You sell human beings short. Palmer, you think if I haven't had your religious experience, I can't appreciate the magnificence of your God. But it's just the opposite. I listen to you and I think, his God is too small. One paltry planet a few thousand years? Hardly worth the attention of a minor deity, much less the creator of the universe.
Oh, you're confusing me with some other preacher, That museum was Brother Rankin's territory. I'm prepared for a universe billions of years old. I just say the scientists haven't proved it.
And I say you haven't understood the evidence. How can it benefit the people if the conventional wisdom, the religious truths, are a lie? When you really believe that people can be adults, you'll preach a different sermon.
There was a brief silence, punctuated only by the echoes of their footfalls.
I'm sorry if I've been a little too strident, she said. It happens to me from time to time.
I give you my word, Dr. Arroway. I'll carefully ponder what you've said this evening. You've raised some questions I should have answers for. But in the same spirit, let me ask you a few questions. Okay?
She nodded, and he continued. Think of what consciousness feels like. What it feels like this minute. Does that feel like billions of tiny atoms wiggling in place? And beyond the biological machinery, where in science can a child learn what love is? Her beeper buzzed. It was probably Ken with the news she had been waiting for. If so, it had been a very long meeting for him. Maybe it was good news, nevertheless. She glanced at the letters and numbers forming in the liquid crystal. Ken's office number. There were no public telephones in sight, but after a few minutes they were able to flag down a taxicab. I'm sorry I have to leave so suddenly, she apologized. I enjoyed our conversation, and I'll think seriously about your questions. Oh, you wanted to pose one more?
Yes.
What is there in the precepts of science that keeps a scientist from doing evil?
Chapter 15. Erbium Dowell. The Earth, that is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them.
Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, Song of the Open Road, 1855. It took years. It was a technological dream and a diplomatic nightmare. But finally they got around to building the machine. Various neologisms were proposed and project names evocative of ancient myths. But from the beginning, everyone had called it simply the machine, and that became its official designation. The continuing complex and delicate international negotiations were described by Western editorial writers as machine politics. When the first reliable estimate of the total cost was generated, even the titans of the aerospace industry gasped. Eventually, it came to $500 billion a year for some years, roughly a third of the total military budget, nuclear and conventional, of the planet. There were fears that building the machine would ruin the world economy. "Economic warfare from Vega?" asked the London Economist. The daily headlines in the New York Times were, by any dispassionate measure, more bizarre than any in the now defunct National Enquirer a decade earlier. The record will show that no psychic, seer, prophet, or soothsayer, no person with claimed precognitive abilities, no astrologer, no numerologist, and no late December copywriter on the year ahead had predicted the message or the machine, much less Vega, prime numbers, Adolf Hitler, the Olympics, and the rest. There were many claims, however, by those who had clearly foreseen the events, but had carelessly neglected to write the precognition down. Predictions of surprising events always prove more accurate, if not set down on paper beforehand. It is one of those odd regularities of everyday life. Many religions were in a slightly different category. A careful and imaginative perusal of their sacred writings will reveal, it was argued, a clear foretelling of these wondrous happenings. For others, the machine represented a potential bonanza for the world aerospace industry, which had been in worrisome decline since the Hiroshima Accords took full force. Very few new strategic weapons systems were under development. Habitats in space were a growing business, but they hardly compensated for the loss of orbiting laser battle stations and other accoutrements of the strategic defense envisioned by an earlier administration. Thus, some of those who worried about the safety of the planet if the machine were to be built swallowed their scruples when contemplating the implications for jobs, profits, and career advancement.
A well-placed few argued that there was no richer prospect for the high-technology industries than a threat from space. There would have to be defenses, immensely powerful surveillance radars, eventual outposts on Pluto or in the Oort comet cloud. No amount of discourse about military disparities between terrestrials and extraterrestrials could daunt these visionaries. "Even if we can't defend ourselves against them," they asked, "don't you want us to see them coming?" There was profit here, and they could smell it. They were building the machine, of course, trillions of dollars worth of machine. But the machine was only the beginning, if they played their cards right. An unlikely political alliance coalesced behind the re-election of President Lasker, which became, in effect, a national referendum on whether to build the machine. Her opponent warned of Trojan horses and doomsday machines, and the prospect of demoralization of American ingenuity in the face of aliens who had already invented everything. The president pronounced herself confident that American technology would rise to the challenge, and implied, although she did not actually say, that American ingenuity would eventually equal anything they had on Vega. She was reelected by a respectable, but by no means overwhelming margin. The instructions themselves were a decisive factor. Both in the primer on language and basic technology, and in the message on the construction of the machine, nothing was left unclear. Sometimes intermediate steps that seemed entirely obvious were spelled out in tedious detail, as when, in the foundations of arithmetic, it is proved that if 2 times 3 equals 6, then 3 times 2 also equals 6. At every stage of construction, there were checkpoints. The erbium produced by this process should be 96% pure, with no more than a fraction of a percent impurity from the other rare earths. When component 31 is completed and placed in a 6-molar solution of hydrofluoric acid, the remaining structural elements should look like the diagram in the accompanying figure. When component 408 is assembled, application of a 2 megagauss transverse magnetic field should spin the rotor up to so many revolutions per second before it returns itself to a motionless state. If any of the tests failed, you went back and redid the whole business. After a while, you got used to the tests, and you expected to be able to pass them. It was akin to rote memorization. Many of the underlying components, constructed by special factories designed from scratch by following the primer instructions, defied human understanding. It was hard to see why they should work, but they did. Even in such cases, practical applications of the new technologies could be contemplated. Occasionally, promising insights seemed to be available for the skimming.
In metallurgy, for example.
Or in organic semiconductors. In some cases, several alternative technologies were supplied to produce an equivalent component. The extraterrestrials could not be sure, apparently, which approach would be easiest for the technology of the Earth. As the first factories were built and the first prototypes produced, pessimism diminished about human ability to reconstruct an alien technology from a message written in no known language. There was the heady feeling of arriving unprepared for a school test and finding that you can figure out the answers from your general education and your common sense. As in all competently designed examinations, taking it was a learning experience. All the first tests were passed. The erbium was of adequate purity. The pictured superstructure was left after the inorganic material was etched away by hydrofluoric acid. The rotor spun up as advertised. The message flattered the scientists and engineers, critics said. They were becoming caught up in the technology and losing sight of the dangers. For the construction of one component, a particularly intricate set of organic chemical reactions was specified, and the resulting product was introduced into a swimming pool-sized mixture of formaldehyde and aqueous ammonia. The mass grew, differentiated, specialized, and then just sat there, exquisitely more complex than anything like it humans knew how to build. It had an intricately branched network of fine hollow tubes, through which perhaps some fluid was to circulate.
It was colloidal,
pulpy, dark red. It did not make copies of itself, but it was sufficiently biological to scare a great many people. They repeated the procedure and produced something apparently identical. How the end product could be significantly more complicated than the instructions that went into building it was a mystery. The organic mass squatted on its platform and did, so far as anyone could tell, nothing. It was to go inside the dodecahedron, just above and below the crew area. Identical machines were under construction in the United States and the Soviet Union. Both nations had chosen to build in fairly remote places, not so much to protect population centers in case it was a doomsday machine, as to control access by curiosity seekers, protesters, and the media. In the United States, the machine was built in Wyoming. In the Soviet Union, just beyond the Caucasus, in the Uzbek SSR. New factories were established near the assembly sites, where components could be manufactured with something like existing industry. Manufacturing was widely dispersed. An optical subcontractor in Jena, for example, would make and test components to go to the American and Soviet machines and to Japan, where every component was systematically examined to understand how it worked, so far as was possible. Progress out of Hokkaido had been slow. There was concern that a component subjected to a test unauthorized in the message might destroy some subtle symbiosis of the various components in a functioning machine. A major substructure of the machine was three exterior concentric spherical shells, arranged with axes perpendicular to each other, and designed to spin at high velocities. The spherical shells were to have precise and intricate patterns cut into them. Would a shell that had been whirled a few times in an unauthorized test function improperly when assembled into the machine? Would an inexperienced shell, by contrast, work perfectly? Haddon Industries was the American prime contractor for machine construction. Saul Haddon had insisted on no unauthorized testing or even mounting of components intended for eventual assembly into the machine. The instructions he ordered were to be followed to the bit, there being no letters per se in the message. He urged his employees to think of themselves as medieval necromancers, fastidiously following the words of a magic spell. "Do not dare to mispronounce a syllable," he told them. This was, depending on which calendrical or eschatological doctrine you fancied, 2 years before the millennium. So many people were retiring in happy anticipation of doomsday or the advent or both that in some industries, skilled laborers were in short supply. Haddon's willingness to restructure his workforce to optimize machine construction and to provide incentives for subcontractors was seen to be a major factor in the American success so far. But Haddon had also retired, a surprise, considering the well-known views of the inventor of Preechniks. "The Kiliasts made an atheist out of me," he was quoted as saying. Key decisions were still in his hands, his subordinates said. But communication with Haddon was via fast, asynchronous telenetting. His subordinates would leave progress reports, authorization requests, and questions for him in a locked box of a popular scientific telenetting service. His answers would come back in another locked box. It was a peculiar arrangement, but it seemed to be working. As the early, most difficult steps were cleared, and the machine actually was beginning to take shape, less and less was heard from S.R. Haddon. The executives of the World Machine Consortium were concerned, but after what was described as a lengthy visit with Mr. Haddon in an unrevealed location, they came away reassured. His whereabouts were unknown to everyone else. The world's strategic inventories fell below 3,200 nuclear weapons for the first time since the middle 1950s. Multilateral talks on the more difficult stages of disarmament down to a minimum nuclear deterrent, were making progress. The fewer the weapons on one side, the more dangerous would be the sequestering of a small number of weapons by the other. And with the number of delivery systems, which were much easier to verify, also diminishing steeply, with new means of automatic monitoring of treaty compliance being deployed, and with new agreements on on-site inspection, the prospects for further reductions seemed good. The process had generated a kind of momentum of its own in the minds of both the experts and the public. As occurs in the usual kind of arms race, the two powers were vying to keep up with one another, but this time in arms reductions. In practical military terms, they had not yet given up very much. They still retained the capability of destroying the planetary civilization. However, in the optimism generated for the future, in the hope engendered in the emerging generation, this beginning had already accomplished much. Aided, perhaps, by the imminent worldwide millennial celebrations, both secular and canonical, the number of armed hostilities between nations per year had diminished still further. The peace of God, the Cardinal Archbishop of Mexico City had called it. In Wyoming and Uzbekistan, new industries had been created, and whole cities were rising from the ground. The cost was borne disproportionately by the industrialized nations, of course, but the pro rata cost for everyone on Earth was something like $100 per year. For a quarter of the Earth's population, $100 was a significant fraction of annual income. The money spent on the machine produced no goods or services directly, but in stimulating new technology, it was deemed a great bargain, even if the machine itself never worked. There were many who felt that the pace had been too swift, that every step should be understood before moving on to the next. If the construction of the machine took generations, it was argued, so what? Spreading the development costs over decades would lessen the economic burden to the world economy of building the machine. By many standards, this was prudent advice, but it was difficult to implement. How could you develop only one component of the machine? All over the world, scientists and engineers of varying disciplinary persuasions were straining to be let loose on those aspects of the machine that overlapped their areas of expertise. There were some who worried that were the machine not built quickly, it would never be built. The American president and the Soviet premier had committed their nations to the construction of the machine. This was not guaranteed for all possible successors. Also, for perfectly understandable personal reasons, those controlling the project wished to see it completed while they were still in positions of responsibility. Some argued that there was an intrinsic urgency to a message broadcast on so many frequencies so loudly and for so long. They were not asking us to build the machine when we were ready. They were asking us to build it now. The pace quickened. All the early subsystems were based on elementary technologies described in the first part of the primer. The prescribed tests had been passed readily enough. As the later, more complex subsystems were tested, occasional failures were noted. This was apparent in both nations, but was more frequent in the Soviet Union. Since no one knew how the components worked, it was usually impossible to trace backwards from failure mode to identification of the flawed step in the manufacturing process. In some cases, the components were made in parallel by two different manufacturers, with competition for speed and accuracy. If there were two components, both of which had passed tests, there was a tendency for each nation to select the domestic product. Thus, the machines that were being assembled in the two countries were not absolutely identical. Finally, in Wyoming, the day came to begin systems integration, the assembling of the separate components into a complete machine. It was likely to be the easiest part of the construction process. Completion within a year or two seemed likely. Some thought that activating the machine would end the world right on schedule. The rabbits were much more astute in Wyoming, or less. It was hard to figure out. The headlights on the Thunderbird had picked up an occasional rabbit near the road more than once, but hundreds of them organized in ranks.
That custom apparently had not yet spread from New Mexico to Wyoming. The situation here was not much different from Argus, Ellie found. There was a major scientific facility, surrounded by tens of thousands of square kilometers of lovely, almost uninhabited landscape. She wasn't running the show, and she wasn't one of the crew, but she was here, working on one of the grandest enterprises ever contemplated. Surely no matter what happened after the machine was activated, the Argus discovery would be judged a turning point in human history. Just at the moment when some additional unifying force is needed, this bolt comes from the blue. From the black, she corrected herself. From 26 light years away, 230 trillion kilometers. It's hard to think of your primary allegiance as Scottish or Slovenian or Sichuanese when you're all being hailed indiscriminately by a civilization millennia ahead of you. The gap between the most technologically backward nation on the earth and the industrialized nations was certainly much smaller than the gap between the industrialized nations and the beings on Vega. Suddenly, distinctions that had earlier seemed transfixing, racial, religious, national, ethnic, linguistic, economic, and cultural, began to seem a little less pressing. We are all humans. This was a phrase you heard often these days. It was remarkable, in previous decades, how infrequently sentiments of this sort had been expressed, especially in the media. We share the same small planet, it was said, and very nearly the same global civilization. It was hard to imagine the extraterrestrials taking seriously a plea for preferential parley from representatives of one or another ideological faction. The existence of the message, even apart from its enigmatic function, was binding up the world. You could see it happening before your eyes. Her mother's first question when she heard that Ellie had not been selected was, "Did you cry?" Yes, she had cried. It was only natural. There was, of course, a part of her that longed to be aboard. But Drumlin was a first-rate choice, she had told her mother. No decision had been made by the Soviets between Lunacharsky and Arkhangelsky. Both would train for the mission. It was hard to see what training might be appropriate, beyond understanding the machine as best they or anyone else could. Some Americans charged that this was merely an attempt by the Soviets to acquire two principal machine spokesmen. But Ellie thought this was mean-spirited. Both Lunacharsky and Arkhangelsky were extremely capable. She wondered how the Soviets would decide which to send. Lunacharsky was in the United States, but not here in Wyoming. He was in Washington, with a high-level Soviet delegation meeting with the Secretary of State and Michael Kitts, newly promoted to Deputy Secretary of Defense. Arkhangelsky was back in Uzbekistan. The new metropolis growing up in the Wyoming wilderness was called Machine. Machine, Wyoming. Its Soviet counterpart was given the Russian equivalent, Makina. Each was a complex of residences, utilities, residential and business districts, and most of all, factories. Some of them were unpretentious, at least on the outside. But in others, you could see in a single glance their bizarre aspects. Domes and minarets, miles of intricate exterior piping. Only the factories that were adjudged potentially dangerous, those manufacturing the organic components, for example, were here in the Wyoming wilderness. Technologies better understood were distributed worldwide. The core of the cluster of new industries was the Systems Integration Facility, built near what had once been Wagon Wheel, Wyoming, to which completed components were consigned. Sometimes Ellie would see a component arrive and realize that she had been the first human being ever to see it as a design drawing. As each new part was uncrated, she would rush to inspect it. As components were mounted one upon another, and as subsystems passed their prescribed tests, she felt a kind of glow that she guessed was akin to maternal pride. Ellie, Drumlin, and Valerian arrived for a routine and long-scheduled meeting on the now wholly redundant worldwide monitoring of the signal from Vega. When they arrived, they found everyone talking about the burning of Babylon.
It had happened in the early hours of the morning, perhaps at a time when the place was prowled only by its most iniquitous and unregenerate habitués. A raiding party, equipped with mortars and incendiaries, had struck simultaneously through the Enlil and Ishtar gates. The ziggurat had been put to the torch. There was a photograph of improbably and scantily clad people rushing from the Temple of Assur. Remarkably, no one was killed, although there were many injuries. Just before the attack, the New York Sun, a paper controlled by the Earth Firsters and sporting a globe shattered by a lightning bolt on its masthead, received a call announcing that the attack was underway. It was divinely inspired retribution, the caller volunteered, carried out on behalf of decency and American morality by those sick and tired of filth and corruption. There were statements by the president of Babylon Incorporated decrying the attack and condemning an alleged criminal conspiracy. But, at least so far, not a word from S.R. Haddon, wherever he might be. Because Ellie was known to have visited Haddon in Babylon, a few of the project personnel sought out her reaction. Even Drumlin was interested in her opinion on this matter, although, from his evident knowledge of the geography of the place, it seemed possible that he had visited it more than once himself. She had no trouble imagining him as charioteer. But perhaps he had only read about Babylon. Photomaps had been published in the weekly news magazines. Eventually, they got back to business. Fundamentally, the message was continuing on the same frequencies, bandpasses, time constants, and polarization and phase modulation. The machine design and the primer were still sitting underneath the prime numbers and the Olympic broadcast. The civilization in the Vega system seemed very dedicated. Or maybe they had just forgotten to turn off the transmitter. Valerian had a faraway look in his eyes.
Peter, why do you have to look at the ceiling when you think?
Drumlin was reputed to have mellowed over the last few years, but as with this comment, his reform was not always apparent. Being chosen by the President of the United States to represent the nation to the extraterrestrials was, he would say, a great honor. The trip, he told his intimates, would be the crowning point of his life. His wife, temporarily transplanted to Wyoming and still doggedly faithful, had to endure the same slideshows presented to new audiences of scientists and technicians building the machine. Since the site was near his native Montana, Drumlin visited there briefly from time to time. Once Ellie had driven him to Missoula. For the first time in their relationship, he had been cordial to her for a few consecutive hours.
"Shh, I'm thinking," replied Valerian. "It's a noise suppression technique. I'm trying to minimize the distractions in my visual field. And then you present a distraction in the audio spectrum. You might ask me why I don't just as well stare at a piece of blank paper. But the trouble is that the paper is too small. I can see things in my peripheral vision. Anyway, what I was thinking is this. Why are we still getting the Hitler message? The Olympic broadcast? Years have passed. They must have received the British coronation broadcast by now. Why haven't we seen some close-ups of orb and scepter and ermine, and a voice intoning, 'Now crowned as George the Sixth, by the grace of God, King of England and Northern Ireland and Emperor of India.'"
"Are you sure Vega was over England at the time of the coronation transmission?" Ellie asked.
"Yes. We checked that out within a few weeks of receipt of the Olympic broadcast. And the intensity was stronger than the Hitler thing. I'm sure Vega could have picked up the coronation transmission."
"You're worried that they don't want us to know everything they know about us?" she asked.
"They're in a hurry," said Valerian.
He was given occasionally to Delphic utterances.
"More likely," offered Ellie, "they want to keep reminding us that they know about Hitler."
"Oh, that's not entirely different from what I'm saying," Valerian replied.
"All right, let's not waste too much time in fantasy land," Drumlin groaned.
He was always impatient with speculation on extraterrestrial motivation. "It was a total waste of time to guess," he would say. "We'll know soon enough." Meanwhile, he urged all and sundry to concentrate on the message. It was hard data, redundant, unambiguous, brilliantly composed.
Here, a little reality might fix you two up. Why don't we go into the assembly area? I think they're doing systems integration with the erbium dowels.
The geometric design of the machine was simple. The details were extremely complex. The five chairs in which the crew would sit were amidships in the dodecahedron, where it bulged out most prominently. There were no facilities for eating or sleeping or other bodily functions, clear evidence that the trip aboard the machine, if there was one, would be short. Some thought this meant that the machine, when activated, would quickly rendezvous with an interstellar space vehicle in the vicinity of the Earth. The only difficulty was that meticulous radar and optical searches could find no trace of such a ship. It seemed scarcely likely that the extraterrestrials had overlooked elementary human physiological needs. Maybe the machine didn't go anywhere. Maybe it did something to the crew. There were no instruments in the crew area, nothing to steer with, not even an ignition key, just the five chairs, pointed inward, so each crew member could watch the others. And there was a carefully prescribed upper limit on the weight of the crew and their belongings. In practice, the constraint worked to the advantage of people of small stature. Above and below the crew area, in the tapering part of the dodecahedron, were the organics, with their intricate and puzzling architecture. Placed throughout the interior of this part of the dodecahedron, apparently at random, were the dowels of erbium. And surrounding the dodecahedron were the three concentric spherical shells, each in a way representing one of the three physical dimensions. The shells were apparently magnetically suspended. At least the instructions included a powerful magnetic field generator. And the space between the spherical shells and the dodecahedron was to be a high vacuum. The message did not name any machine component. Erbium was identified as the atom with 68 protons and 99 neutrons. The various parts of the machine were also described numerically. Component 31, for example. So the rotating, concentric, spherical shells were named benzels by a Czech technician who knew something of the history of technology. Gustav Benzel had, in 1870, invented the merry-go-round. The design and function of the machine were unfathomed. It required whole new technologies to construct. But it was made of matter. The structure could be diagrammed. Indeed, cutaway engineering drawings had appeared in mass media all over the world, and its finished form was readily visualized. There was a continuing mood of technological optimism. Drumlin, Valerian, and Arroway went through the usual identification sequence involving credentials, thumbprint, and voiceprint, and were then admitted to the vast assembly bay. Three-story overhead cranes were positioning erbium dowels in the organic matrix. Several pentagonal panels for the exterior of the dodecahedron were hanging from an elevated railroad track. While the Soviets had had some problems, the U.S. subsystems had finally passed all their tests, and the overall architecture of the machine was gradually emerging.
"It's all coming together," Ellie thought.
She looked to where the Benzels would be assembled. When completed, the machine would look from the outside like one of those armillary spheres of the Renaissance astronomers. What would Johannes Kepler have made of all this? The floor and the circumferential tracks at various altitudes in the assembly buildings were crowded with technicians, government officials, and representatives of the World Machine Consortium. As they watched, Valerian mentioned that the president had established an occasional correspondence with his wife, who would not tell Peter even what it was about. She had pleaded the right of privacy. The positioning of the dowels was almost completed, and a major systems integration test was about to be attempted for the first time. Some thought the prescribed monitoring device was a gravity wave telescope. Just as the test was to begin, they walked around a stanchion to get a better view. Suddenly, Drumlin was in the air, flying. Everything else seemed to be flying, too. It reminded her of the tornado that had carried Dorothy to Oz. As in a slow-motion film, Drumlin careened toward her. arms outstretched. I knocked her roughly to the ground. After all these years, she thought, was this his notion of a sexual overture? He had a lot to learn.
It was never determined who did it. Organizations publicly claiming responsibility included the Earth Firsters, the Red Army Faction, the Islamic Jihad, the now underground Fusion Energy Foundation, the Sikh Separatists, Shining Path, the Khmer Vert, the Afghan Renaissance, the radical wing of Mothers Against the Machine, the Reunified Reunification Church, Omega 7, the Doomsday Kiliasts, although Billy Joe Rankin denied any connection and claimed that the confessions were called in by the impious in a doomed attempt to discredit God, the Broderbund, El 14 de Febrero, the Secret Army of the Kuomintang, the Zionist League, the Party of God, and the newly resuscitated Symbionese Liberation Front. Most of these organizations did not have the wherewithal to execute the sabotage. The length of the list was merely an index of how widespread opposition to the machine had become. The Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party, the Democratic National Socialist Party, and a few like-minded organizations restrained themselves and did not claim responsibility. An influential minority of their membership believed that the message had been dispatched by Hitler himself. According to one version, he had been spirited off the earth by German rocket technology in May 1945, and quite some progress had been made by the Nazis in the intervening years. "I don't know where the machine was going," the president said some months later, "but if it was half as whacked out as this planet is, it probably wasn't worth the trip anyway." As reconstructed by the Commission of Inquiry, one of the erbium dowels was sundered by an explosion. The two pillbox-shaped fragments careened downward from a height of 20 meters and were also propelled laterally with considerable velocity. A weight-bearing interior wall was struck and collapsed under the impact. 11 people were killed and 48 injured. A number of major machine components were destroyed, and since an explosion was not among the testing protocols prescribed by the message, the explosion might have ruined apparently unaffected components. When you had no idea at all about how the thing worked, you had to be very careful about building it. Despite the profusion of organizations that craved credit, suspicion in the United States focused immediately on two of the few groups that had not claimed responsibility: the extraterrestrials and the Russians. Talk about doomsday machines filled the air once again. The extraterrestrials had designed the machine to explode catastrophically when assembled, but fortunately, some said, we were careless in assembling it, and only a small charge, perhaps the trigger for the doomsday machine, blew up. They urged halting construction before it was too late and burying the surviving components in widely dispersed salt mines. But the Commission of Inquiry found evidence that the machine disaster, as it came to be known, was of more earthly origin. The dowels had a central ellipsoidal cavity of unknown purpose, and its interior wall was lined with an intricate network of fine gadolinium wires. This cavity had been packed with plastic explosive and a timer, materials not on the message's inventory of parts. The dowel had been machined, the cavity lined, and the finished product tested and sealed in a Haddon cybernetics facility in Terre Haute, Indiana. The gadolinium wiring had been too intricate to do by hand. Robot servo mechanisms were required, and they in turn had required a major factory to be constructed. The cost of building the factory was defrayed entirely by Haddon Cybernetics, but there would be other more profitable applications for its wares. The other three erbium dowels in the same lot were inspected and revealed no plastic explosive. Soviet and Japanese crews had performed a range of remote sensing experiments before daring to split their dowels open. Somebody had carefully packed a tamped charge and timer into the cavity near the end of the construction process in Terre Haute. Once out of the factory, this dowel and those from other batches had been transported by special train and under armed guard to Wyoming. The timing of the explosion and the nature of the sabotage suggested someone with knowledge of the machine construction. It was an inside job.
But the investigation made little progress. There were several dozen people, technicians, quality control analysts, inspectors who sealed the component for transshipment, who had the opportunity to commit the sabotage, if not the means and the motivation. Those who failed polygraph tests had ironclad alibis. None of the suspects let drop a confession in an unguarded moment at the neighborhood bar. None began to spend more than their means allowed. No one broke under interrogation. Despite what were said to be vigorous efforts by law enforcement agencies, the mystery remained unsolved. Those who believed the Soviets responsible argued that their motive was to prevent the United States from activating its machine first. The Russians had the technical capability for the sabotage, and, of course, detailed knowledge of machine construction protocols and practice on both sides of the Atlantic. As soon as the disaster occurred, Anatoly Goldman, a former student of Lunacharsky's, who was working as Soviet liaison in Wyoming, urgently called Moscow and told them to take down all their dowels. At face value, this conversation, which had been routinely monitored by the NSA, seemed to show no Russian involvement, but some argued that the phone call was a sham to deflect suspicion, or that Goldman had not been told of the sabotage beforehand. The argument was picked up by those in the United States made uneasy by the late reduction of tensions between the two nuclear superpowers. Understandably, Moscow was outraged at the suggestion. In fact, the Soviets were having more difficulties in constructing their machine than was generally known. Using the decrypted message, the Ministry of Medium-Heavy Industry made considerable progress in ore extraction,
metallurgy,
machine tools, and the like. The new microelectronics and cybernetics were more difficult, and most of those components for the Soviet machine were produced under contract elsewhere in Europe and in Japan. Even more difficult for Soviet domestic industry was the organic chemistry, much of which required techniques developed in molecular biology. A nearly fatal blow had been dealt Soviet genetics when in the 1930s Stalin decided that modern Mendelian genetics was ideologically unsuitable and decreed as scientifically orthodox the crackpot genetics of a politically sophisticated agriculturalist named Trofim Lysenko. Two generations of bright Soviet students were taught essentially nothing of the fundamentals of heredity. Now, 60 years later, Soviet molecular biology and genetic engineering were comparatively backward, and few major discoveries in the subject had been made by Soviet scientists. Something similar had happened, but abortively, in the United States, where, for theological reasons, attempts had been made to prevent public school students from learning about evolution, the central idea of modern biology. The issue was clear-cut, because a fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible was widely held to be inconsistent with the evolutionary process. Fortunately for American molecular biology, the fundamentalists were not as influential in the United States as Stalin had been in the Soviet Union. The National Intelligence Estimate, prepared for the president on the matter, concluded that there was no evidence of Soviet involvement in the sabotage. Rather, since the Soviets had parity with the Americans in crew membership, they had strong incentives to support the completion of the American machine. "If your technology is at level 3," explained the director of Central Intelligence, "and your adversary is ahead of you at level 4, you're happy when out of the blue level 15 technology appears, provided you have equal access to it and adequate resources." Few officials of the American government believed the Soviets were responsible for the explosion, and the president said as much publicly on more than one occasion. But old habits die hard. "No crackpot group, however well organized, will deflect humanity from this historic goal," the president declared. In practice, though, it was now much more difficult to achieve a national consensus. The sabotage had given new life to every objection, reasonable and unreasonable, that had earlier been raised. Only the prospect of the Soviets completing their machine kept the American project going. His wife had wanted to keep Drumlin's funeral a family affair, But in this, as in much else, her well-meaning intentions were thwarted. Physicists, parasailers, hang gliding aficionados, government officials, scuba enthusiasts, radio astronomers, skydivers, aquaplaners, and the World SETI community all wanted to attend. For a while, they had contemplated holding the services at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City as the only church in the country of adequate size. But Drumlin's wife won a small victory, and the ceremony was held outdoors in his hometown of Missoula, Montana. The authorities had agreed because Missoula simplified the security problems. Although Valerian was not badly injured, his physicians advised him against attending the funeral. Nevertheless, he gave one of the eulogies from a wheelchair. Drumlin's special genius was in knowing what questions to ask, Valerian said. He had approached the SETI problem skeptically, because skepticism was at the heart of science. Once it was clear that a message was being received, no one was more dedicated or resourceful in figuring it out. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, Michael Kitts, representing the President, stressed Drumlin's personal qualities, his warmth, his concern for the feelings of others, his brilliance, his remarkable athletic ability. If not for this tragic and dastardly event, Drumlin would have gone down in history as the first American to visit another star. No peroration from her, Ellie had told Terhier. No press interviews, maybe a few photographs. She understood the importance of a few photographs. She didn't trust herself to say the right thing. For years, she had served as a kind of public spokesperson for SETI, for Argus, and then for the message and the machine. But this was different. She needed some time to work this one through. As nearly as she could tell, Drumlin had died saving her life. He had seen the explosion before others heard it, had spied the several hundred kilogram mass of erbium arcing toward them. With his quick reflexes, he had leapt to push her back behind the stanchion. She had mentioned this as a possibility to Terhier, who replied, Drumlin was probably leaping to save himself, and you were just in the way. The remark was ungracious. Was it also intended to be ingratiating? Or, perhaps, Terhier had gone on, sensing her displeasure, Drumlin had been thrown into the air by the concussion of the erbium hitting the staging surface. But she was absolutely sure. She had seen the whole thing. Drumlin's concern was to save her life, and he had. Except for a few scratches, Ellie was physically unhurt. Valerian, who had been entirely protected by the stanchion, had both legs broken by a collapsing wall. She had been fortunate in more ways than one. She had not even been knocked unconscious. Her first thought, as soon as she had understood what had happened, was not for her old teacher David Drumlin crushed horribly before her eyes, not amazement at the prospect of Drumlin giving up his life for hers, not the setback to the entire machine project. Nope, clear as a bell, her thought had been, I can go. They'll have to send me. There's nobody else. I get to go. She had caught herself in an instant, but it was too late. She was aghast at her self-involvement, at the contemptible egotism she had revealed to herself in this moment of crisis. It didn't matter that Drumlin might have had similar failings. She was appalled to find them even momentarily within her, so vigorous, busy, planning future courses of action, oblivious of everything except herself. What she detested most was the absolute unself-consciousness of her ego. It made no apologies, gave no quarter, and plunged on. It was unwholesome. She knew it would be impossible to tear it out, root and branch. She would have to work on it patiently, reason with it, distract it, maybe even threaten it. When the investigators arrived on the scene, she was uncommunicative. I'm afraid I can't tell you much. The three of us were walking together in the staging area, and suddenly there was an explosion and everything was flying up into the air. I'm sorry I can't help. I wish I could. She made it clear to her colleagues that she did not want to talk about it. and disappeared into her apartment for so long that they sent a scouting party to inquire after her. She tried recalling every nuance of the incident. She tried to reconstruct their conversation before they had entered the staging area, what she and Drumlin had talked about on their drive to Missoula, what Drumlin had seemed like when she first met him at the beginning of her graduate school career. Gradually, she discovered that there was a part of her that had wished Drumlin dead. Even before they became competitors for the American seat on the machine. She hated him for having diminished her before the other students in class, for opposing Argus, for what he had said to her the moment after the Hitler film had been reconstructed. She had wanted him dead. And now he was dead. By a certain reasoning, she recognized it immediately as convoluted and spurious. She believed herself responsible. Would he even have been here if not for her? Certainly, she told herself, someone else would have discovered the message, and Drumlin would have leapt in, so to say. But had she not, through her own scientific carelessness, perhaps, provoked him into deeper involvement in the machine project? Step by step, she worked through the possibilities. If they were distasteful, she worked especially hard on them. There was something hiding there. She thought about men. Men who, for one reason or another, she had admired. Drumlin, Valerian, Drahir, Haddon, Joss, Jesse, Staunton, her father.
Dr. Arroway?
Ellie was roused somewhat gratefully from this meditation by a stout blonde woman of middle age in a blue print dress. Her face was somehow familiar. The cloth identification badge on her ample bosom read, H. Bork, Göteborg.
Dr. Arroway, I'm so sorry for our loss. David told me all about you.
Of course. The legendary Helga Bork, Drumlin's scuba diving companion in so many tedious graduate student slideshows. Who, she wondered for the first time, had taken those pictures? Did they invite a photographer to accompany them on their underwater trysts?
He told me how close you both were.
What is this woman trying to tell me? Did Drumlin insinuate to her? Her eyes welled with tears.
I'm sorry, Dr. Bork. I don't feel very well right now.
Head lowered, she hurried away. There were many at the funeral she wanted to see. Vege, Arkhangelsky, Gottrich, Maruda, you, she, Devi, and Abonema Eda, who was increasingly being talked about as the fifth crew member, if the nations had any sense, she thought, and if there was to be such a thing as a completed machine. But her social stamina was in tatters, and she could not now abide long meetings. For one thing, she didn't trust herself to speak. How much that she'd be saying would be for the good of the project, and how much to satisfy her own needs. The others were sympathetic and understanding. She had, after all, been the person closest to Drumlin when the erbium dowel struck and pulped him. Chapter 16. The Elders of Ozone. The god whom science recognizes must be a god of universal laws exclusively. A god who does a wholesale, not a retail business. He cannot accommodate his processes to the convenience of individuals. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902. At a few hundred kilometers altitude, the earth fills half your sky, and the band of blue that stretches from Mindanao to Bombay, which your eye encompasses in a single glance, can break your heart with its beauty. Home, you think. Home. This is my world. This is where I come from. Everyone I know, everyone I ever heard of, grew up down there, under that relentless and exquisite blue. You race eastward from horizon to horizon, from dawn to dawn, circling the planet in an hour and a half. After a while, you get to know it. You study its idiosyncrasies and anomalies. You can see so much with a naked eye. Florida will soon be in view again. Has that tropical storm system you saw last orbit, swirling and racing over the Caribbean, reached Fort Lauderdale? Are any of the mountains in the Hindu Kush snow-free this summer? You tend to admire the aquamarine reefs in the Coral Sea. You look at the West Antarctic ice pack and wonder whether its collapse could really inundate all the coastal cities on the planet. In the daylight, though, it's hard to see any sign of human habitation. But at night, except for the polar aurora, everything you see is due to humans humming and blinking all over the planet. That swath of light is eastern North America, continuous from Boston to Washington. A megalopolis, in fact, if not in name. Over there is the burn-off of natural gas in Libya. The dazzling lights of the Japanese shrimp fishing fleet have moved toward the South China Sea. On every orbit, the Earth tells you new stories. You can see a volcanic eruption in Kamchatka, a Saharan sandstorm approaching Brazil, unseasonably frigid weather in New Zealand. You get to thinking of the Earth as an organism, a living thing. You get to worry about it, care for it, wish it well. National boundaries are as invisible as meridians of longitude or the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. The boundaries are arbitrary. The planet is real. Spaceflight, therefore, is subversive. If they are fortunate enough to find themselves in Earth orbit, most people, after a little meditation, have similar thoughts. The nations that had instituted spaceflight had done so largely for nationalistic reasons. It was a small irony that almost everyone who entered space received a startling glimpse of a transnational perspective of the Earth as one world. It wasn't hard to imagine a time when the predominant loyalty would be to this blue world, or even to the cluster of worlds huddling around the nearby yellow dwarf star, on which humans, once unaware that every star is a sun, had bestowed the definite article, the sun. It was only now, when many people were entering space for long periods and had been afforded a little time for reflection, that the power of the planetary perspective began to be felt. A significant number of these occupants of low Earth orbit, it turned out, were influential down there on Earth. They had, from the beginning, from before humans ever entered space, sent animals up there. Amoebas, fruit flies, rats, dogs, and apes had become hardy space veterans. As space flights of longer and longer duration became possible, something unexpected was found. It had no effect on microorganisms and little effect on fruit flies, but for mammals, it seemed, zero gravity extended the lifespan by 10 or 20%. If you lived in zero G, your body would spend less energy fighting the force of gravity, your cells would oxidize more slowly, and you would live longer. There were some physicians who claimed that the effects would be much more pronounced on humans than on rats. There was the faintest aroma of immortality in the air. The rate of new cancers was down 80% for the orbital animals compared with a control group on the Earth. Leukemia and lymphatic carcinomas were down 90%. There was even some evidence, perhaps not yet statistically significant, that the spontaneous remission rate for neoplastic diseases was much greater in zero gravity. The German chemist Otto Warburg had, half a century before, proposed that oxidation was the cause of many cancers. The lower cellular oxygen consumption in the weightless condition suddenly seemed very attractive. People who in earlier decades would have made a pilgrimage to Mexico for Latreille now clamored for a ticket into space, but the price was exorbitant. Whether preventive or clinical medicine, spaceflight was for the few. Suddenly, hitherto unheard-of sums of money became available for investment in civilian orbital stations. By the very end of the second millennium, there were rudimentary retirement hotels a few hundred kilometers up. Aside from the expense, there was a serious disadvantage, of course. Progressive osteological and vascular damage would make it impossible for you ever to come back to the gravitational field at the surface of the Earth. But for some of the wealthy elderly, this was no major impediment. In exchange for another decade of life, they were happy to retire to the sky and eventually to die there. There were those who worried that this was an imprudent investment of the limited wealth of the planet. There were too many urgent needs and just grievances of the poor and powerless to spend it on pampering the rich and powerful. It was foolhardy, they said, to permit an elite class to emigrate to space with the masses left back on Earth, a planet, in effect, given over to absentee landlords. Others professed it to be a godsend. The owners of the planet were picking up in droves and leaving. They couldn't do nearly as much damage up there, it was argued, as down here. Hardly anyone anticipated the principal outcome, the transfer of a vivid planetary perspective to those who could do the most good. After some years, there were few nationalists left in Earth orbit. Global nuclear confrontation poses real problems for those with a penchant for immortality. There were Japanese industrialists, Greek shipping tycoons, Saudi crown princes, one ex-president, a former party general secretary, a Chinese robber baron, and a retired heroin kingpin. In the West, aside from a few promotional invitations, there was only one criterion for residence in Earth orbit. You had to be able to pay. The Soviet hostel was different. It was called a space station, and the former party secretary was said to be there for gerontological research. By and large, the multitudes were not resentful. One day, they imagined, they would go too. Those in Earth orbit tended to be circumspect, careful, quiet. Their families and staffs had similar personal qualities. They were the focus of discreet attention by other rich and powerful people still on Earth. They made no public pronouncements, but their views gradually permeated the thinking of leaders worldwide. The continuing divestment of nuclear weapons by the five nuclear powers was something the venerables in orbit supported. Quietly, they had endorsed the building of the machine because of its potential to unify the world. Occasionally, nationalist organizations would write about a vast conspiracy in Earth orbit, doddering do-gooders selling out their motherlands. There were pamphlets that purported to be stenographic transcripts of a meeting aboard Methuselah, attended by representatives of the other private space stations who had been ferried over for the purpose. A list of action items was produced, calculated to strike terror in the heart of the most lukewarm patriot. The pamphlets were spurious, Times Week announced. It called them the Protocols of the Elders of Ozone.